In Milwaukee this week, the county board approved a 0.4% sales tax to shore up its budget and prevent deep cuts to services. This vote follows one earlier this month in the city of Milwaukee that raises the sales tax there by 2%. In education news, widespread restraint and seclusion practices in schools are disproportionately used in elementary grades and on students with disabilities. That's according to a recent report from the Department of Public Instruction, which called the rates concerningly high, with some 5,900 incidents of seclusion and 6,900 of restraint. A 2019 law required DPI to start collecting data on use of these practices and limit their use. Physical restraint is defined as a restriction that immobilizes or reduces the ability of a student to freely move their torso, arms, legs, or head. It may only be used when a student's behavior presents a clear, present, and imminent risk to the physical safety of the student or others. Seclusion means the involuntary confinement of a student apart from other students in a room or area from which the student is physically prevented from leaving. DPI says the use of these practices must be a last resort. For reaction to the widespread use of these practices, we sat down with Madison civil rights attorney Jeff Spitzer Resnick. Having been a chief advocate for laws restricting seclusion and restraint in schools, what's your reaction to the latest DPI reporting that there are these thousands of incidents in the 2021-22 school year?
Well, there's a few reactions. The first reaction is, wow, that's a lot of kids who are suffering from really an abhorrent behavior on adults' part, being secluded, restrained. I would ask any adult to imagine themselves being held against their will and being put into a room that where no one else is, how they would feel. But second, when we look at the numbers, we see that it's a huge percentage, almost all of them are in elementary school. So we have these young children. Now, you might ask me, why are they young children? As children grow older, staff just aren't going to, they're just not going to try that with a bigger kid. So this power imbalance is really problematic. It's like we can so-called get away with it with young children. Let's assume for the moment that the ones that are reporting that they have few, if any, kids who they're secluding and restraining. Why aren't we not only celebrating that, but DPI finding out, well, how are you doing that? Can you help us train these other schools that are struggling? Conversely, if you have what I'll call repeat performers, and we generally do, it's usually not an aberration that a school district has lots of seclusion and restraint and then has none the next year. They're going to stay up there with their numbers. I mean, they might go up and down a little bit. What are we doing to change that? If you look at DPI's report, it simply says at the bottom, it lists a few links of resources. Seriously? Is that it? We've got to do better than that.
So you describe accurately how the numbers suggest that it's many as 80% of the children who are restrained or secluded are in grade school. Same holds true for the number of students who are disabled.
Right. You know, look, you've got two things going on with children with disabilities. One is they're simply more vulnerable, and so therefore they are more subject, not only in school but outside of school, to be abused. So that's a problem, and I consider this abuse, by the way. Secondly, are there some of those children that may have more challenging behaviors? Of course there are. That's why they're in special education. That's why we have programs and funding, perhaps insufficient. I won't even say perhaps insufficient, definitely insufficient, to help them. They shouldn't be on the butt end of trauma, and that's what seclusion and restraint will do.
Do you think there is any place in the schools for seclusion and restraint?
So what the law says, and what I believe is true, is if there's an imminent risk, and imminent means imminent, like right now, of serious bodily injury, and emphasize serious, then yes, of course. People asked, I remember when we were trying to get the bill passed, well, wouldn't you stop a kid who was running into a street in front of a car? Of course we'd stop them, and of course we'd restrain them. Temporarily, for a short time, you let them go after the car goes by, and you redirect them away.
Clearly, you don't think those are the only times that this is being used.
Of course not, which also then begs the question, is DPI actually examining? And of course, they can't examine, they don't have the staff to examine thousands, but could they go into the top or bottom, depending on your view, the three school districts that are showing the highest propensity to seclude and restrain and actually look and see, are every one of these students who have been secluded and restrained having done so when there was an imminent risk of harm? I'm 100% sure they will find not. And then what do we do? The problem is, DPI has historically and presently been complaint responsive. So yes, if someone files a complaint, if a parent says my kid was secluded and restrained and there was no imminent risk of harm, DPI will look into it, may order a corrective action plan if they substantiate that. But without that complaint, DPI is just going to say, here's the numbers, here's some resources, and it's just inadequate.
How do these techniques potentially harm children?
Well, it can be very traumatizing, ranging from, you know, short-term trauma where a child, you know, goes home crying to their mother or father or whatever, to what can be, especially if it's repeated. You know, I remember when we had the bill passed, there was a young man who literally was put into a psychotic state after repeatedly being secluded and restrained. I mean, that's an extreme. Many of these kids don't have very good verbal skills or language skills, may have none.
How does the enduring shortage of special education funding play into the use of seclusion and restraint?
We have staff with increasing caseloads. So we've got, you know, both a numbers problem and a training problem, and that certainly is part of why these numbers, high numbers of seclusion and restraint persist.
In a statement responding to Spitzer residents' comments, DPI Communication Director Abigail Sweat said, quote, while I take issue with the characterization of our response as inadequate, I want to make it very clear that we know that each of these data points represents the real lived experience of a child, and that while these are steps taken by staff to protect the safety of the student themselves and the safety of others, they are also traumatic events for those very students and really all involved. Seclusion and restraint should be, is, and needs to continue to be an absolute last resort. Next week, we'll be joined by educators from DPI on this topic. To watch the extended interview with Spitzer Resnick and for more on the issues facing Wisconsin, you can visit our website at pbswisconsin.org and then click on the news tab. That's our program for tonight. I'm Frederica Freiberg. Have a good weekend.